This is Pure Decking, show number 460 for Thursday, December the 9th, 1979. This is a show about stuff that interests me, like information security, rigging the game, and 16-bit games were better. Fight me.
Better than what?
Everything else.
Fuck you, 8-bit, man.
I do enjoy some good 8-bit gaming, too.
That all last night while the power was out.
So we have a Madman. What is up, Madman?
Excitebike was kind of fun.
Excitebike was kind of fun.
And I'm going to go with the first game I know of where you could at least make your own track. So that gets even extra kudos from me.
Madman, you have that multi-system, right?
Oh, yeah.
You ever look into the Everdrives?
No, I haven't.
You should. They're not the cheapest thing in the world, but they are cartridges with an SD card slot in them, so you can take your ROM collection from emulation and load them, or I'm sorry, the ROMs you've legitimately backed up from your, whatever the fuck you're supposed to say these days. So you can put ROMs, however you got them, on the SD card and then play them on the real hardware, or in your case, that FPGA multi-emulator you've got. So, or you just buy a Mister, and then you don't. And then you just run it all straight up off the little DE10 board. But that's a different thing. Are you? What's up?
How much, man? Rampart and probably Populous. Best 8-bit games.
Yeah.
Of the era.
Is that what you were? You said you were playing last night with the power out. Is that?
Nah, man. I was playing some Pokemon last night. Nintendo DS.
Okay.
It was the cartridge in there, man. I just. What was in there?
We talked about that. You discovering that your DS still had power. I went and found my DS XL. Yeah, it still had power in it too. It's like, fuck.
It's my go. When the power goes out, man, I don't even think about anything else now. I just grab the MP3 player and turn on the DS.
I've actually got a collection of parts to Game Boy Advances, mainly the SPs, because those are the ones you can get parts for. So I'm going to be reworking a couple of SPs, painting the cases, and putting IPS screens in them. And, you know, all of these were being sold on eBay as broken. It's like, oh, well, there's no battery, but when you plug it in, it only comes on for a second and turns off. And it's like, yep, that's what an SP does when there's no battery in it. So, sure, exactly. I'll buy that for $30. Get a replacement battery on Amazon for like $5. Sure. So. Anyways, original Pokemon's all right. I never really got into it back in the day.
Oh, I'm not into Pokemon, dude. I just like fighting the fucking things.
Yeah.
I've got no idea what's happening in the story, hence I've been walking around the beginning part since for quite a few games now, until last night I figured out there was a hidden path, and now I can continue on the game, but I've been stuck in that beginning section for about 6 months.
So you've just been power leveling.
Yeah, dude, all my Pokemon are fucking ridiculous levels, and now I'm, you know, continuing on the game. I'm like, oh yeah, it's easy to beat things now.
Yeah, but that reminds me of the first time I played the original Final Fantasy. I figured out the leveling mechanic, right? Because that I didn't really understand what I was doing the first time I played. The first time I played it and understood what I was doing, I think I probably spent 4 hours walking back and forth between the starting town and the Chaos Shrine, just getting all my dudes up to like level 20.
Yeah, I just didn't realize that tree was fake, because I'm not looking at any of the dialect. So like last night, out of frustration, I just started walking around the edges, pushing the walls, because that's what games have told me to do.
People get upset at you when you do that at work, especially in a high rise for some reason.
Trying to find the lunchroom.
No, what's really bad is whenever you go with the "I learned this from Zelda" route and just start dropping bombs in random places to see if a secret door opens up.
And smashing all the pottery you can find.
Yeah.
Eventually, an old man's going to give me a magic sword, officer, I swear.
And I'll hear somebody play the xylophone as I blow open a door. Oh, fuck. video games don't influence people. If they did, we'd all be in dark rooms listening to repetitive electronic music, munching magic pills. Huh. Actually,
mushrooms and changing people in skirts.
Oh, well, there's... actually, though, since we are talking about it, I recently, and by recently I mean a few months ago, picked up one of these Abernick RG280Vs. I don't know if you guys have seen them or not. It's one of those little emulation boxes. And this one's actually really little. It's like the size of an SP folded up. And it sucks for anything beyond Super Nintendo, NES, Genesis. I mean, it'll run stuff like PlayStation. It'll run up to like PlayStation 1 games, but it doesn't have any analog sticks on it. So trying to go beyond that, it really sucks. But for playing the 8 and 16-bit stuff, this thing's actually fantastic. The buttons are a little mushy. That's about my only real complaint, is when you get to about level 20 in Tetris, because the button input isn't perfect, it gets squirrely. So, but that kind of happens with most emulated hardware anyways. So... But what did I pay for this thing? Like $60? I think I caught it on special on AliExpress. So it's not bad. You got to load a better firmware than what it comes with to get it to run right. But once you do that, it's great. Anyways, just a programming note. Next, we're probably going to do a show next week, and then we'll be done for the year probably till. I'm going to go out a limb and say the second week of January. We might come back the first week of January, just kind of depending on how everybody's feeling, see if we're all getting twitchy to yell at the internet or not. We'll see.
Depends if something big goes, too.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, hell, if I have no stories, we may skip next week. So
hell, if war breaks out with Russia and Ukraine.
We won't be doing it. Watching that?
We won't be doing a tech show, that one. I'll actually be hosting that show.
Well, that'd be an IHN again, wouldn't it?
Yeah, we'd just be teaching you how to huddle under your fucking desk, because it feels like it's 1980 all over again.
You need the guy from Dr. Strangelove, Slim Pickens, his survival kit. I can't think of his character's name now.
I mean, for the love of your own sanity, if you don't really know what's going on, don't try and get into it. It's a story that has many, many layers and 10 years of lore to tell you about before you'll even understand what's happening.
Oh, let's just 10 say, years? No, go back to the fall of the Soviet Union when the United States and England both said, Ukraine, if you give us your nukes, we will defend your country from Russia.
Yeah, Major Kong, that was his name. So you need Major Kong's survival pack. That's why I'm just going to leave it at that.
instead of going all the way back to the beginning of time, Madman, I'd say 10 years would be enough to cover this one. And the illustrious McCain is involved. John McCain, who's now gone. Yeah.
That's pretty good. He can start wars from beyond the grave.
Well,
we will stand with you. I watched that speech.
I resent it to you yesterday just to make sure I wasn't insane and that actually did happen.
Oh, with deepfakes these days, who the fuck knows?
And who just died? Who's lying in state?
Bob Dole.
I thought he was already dead.
A lot of people did. I thought he was too. He was like 98.
Yeah, like I'm not.
It's
the
like
only
I'm
one.
Pretty. I thought he died a while ago.
I was the same. Do we know what he died of? Like, was it old age or?
He died old.
Jesus, man. It's
I prefer to think he died. Well, that'd be never mind. I was about to say something really crass.
Dude, he was a World War II vet and hero. He died of old.
I was gonna say like the only thing I remember Bob Dole being is boring. Like he had a real monotone fucking talk. So he never really stood out for me as an American senator.
If you look at his military career, he stood out.
Yeah, I know he had a failed run for election with, who was it?
Presidential run.
Yeah, wasn't he number two on, what's the name's ticket, the climate nut job?
No, he was number one on the ticket. He ran as the Republican.
Oh, really?
I think he presidential lost to Clinton, nominee.
Yeah, probably. Either way,
Clinton.
I think it was Clinton's second term.
Yeah. Anyway, back to tech.
Back to tech. So, continuing on, you know, douchebaggery. We'll start with the one from Ars Technica here. Verizon overrides users' opt-out preferences and push to collect browsing history. And I checked. Yes, they fucking did. Those assholes. Because that's the first thing I always do when I get a new device is I go through and turn off all the tracking. You know, one, I find the tracking obnoxious. Two, it runs your fucking battery down because your thing's constantly sending shit back over the internet. And, you know, I mean, it wastes your data. So, yeah, turn the fucking tracking off just as a matter of practicality. Anyways, Verizon is automatically enrolling customers in a new version of a program that scans mobile users' browser history, even those when those same users had previously opted out of the program when it had a different name. Because it used to be Verizon would give you $5 off your bill a month if you opted into their tracking program. Now they turn it on by default, even if you didn't take the $5. So yeah, you know they can go fucking anthill. The carrier announced changes to its Verizon Selects program, along with a new name a few days ago. Verizon Customer Experience Plus is the new name of our Verizon Selects program, Verizon said in FAQ. Verizon is ignoring the previous opt-out preferences for at least some customers by enrolling them in Custom Experience, which collects browser and app usage history, but not the device location data or other personal information collected in Custom Experience Plus. So they have that one too. Verizon says it does not sell the information collected in either version of customer experience and that the program, quote, no longer supports third-party advertising, unquote. But Verizon does share the data with service providers who work for us and says it uses the data to personalize our communications with you, give you more relevant products and service recommendations, develop plans, services, and offers that are more appealing to you. In other words, they're collecting all this data and hoping that AI will give them something useful out of it. For example, if we think you like music, who doesn't fucking like music? I don't mean a genre of music. It just says music.
I mean, I hate it. Anything melodic at all just
triggers
makes you want to go shoot my neighbor.
It's like, was that two notes? Were those two notes in scale?
Yeah. Oh, after any religious ceremony, I mean, there's mass murder everywhere.
I mean, that's at least the third worst dog massacre where Madman's made a fort in his backyard I've seen in at least a month. Now, anyways, yeah, for example, if we think you like music, we could present you with a Verizon offer that includes music content or provide you with a choice related to a concert in our Verizon Up Reward program. The fuck? Privacy-conscious users will likely want to opt out using the instructions provided by Verizon or in this article. To opt out, go to your Verizon account privacy preferences page again. And I say again because this is the third time I've done it. Scroll down a bit. And you'll see options. It'll say manage settings for both custom experience and custom experience plus. They have a link in the article to go directly to that page as well. Or you can select manage privacy settings in the My Verizon mobile app. In either the website or the mobile app, which, by the way, basically the same thing. There's nothing custom about that app. It's a web browser. The options to manage settings will let you opt in or out of the two versions of customer experience program. You can also delete any browsing location history data that Verizon previously collected by clicking reset. Additionally, account owners can use the Verizon website to block custom experience enrollment for specific lines. I'll tell you, if you're doing the app, you have to go opt out for each device. Because I had to do my phone and my tablet separately. Because for my phone, it turned on custom experience, and for my tablet, it turned on a bunch of shit. I don't remember what they all were. I had to turn them all off and hit that reset because it was like, what the fuck? Because I know I turned all that shit off. Yeah, Verizon customers have good reason to be wary of the carrier's privacy practices. The Federal Communications Commission found last year that Verizon apparently disclosed its customers' location information without their consent to a third party who was not authorized to receive it. The commission proposed a fine of $48 million. In 2016, Verizon agreed to pay a $1.35 million fine for inserting super cookie identifiers into customers' mobile internet traffic without users' knowledge or consent. In 2017, then-President Donald Trump and the Republican Congress blocked implementation of FCC privacy rules that would require home internet and mobile broadband providers to get customers to opt in consent before using... I think there was more to it than that, but yeah, basically did. Verizon has been sending emails to customers. I didn't get one. Notifying them about the program changes. There are different versions of the email, one of which states that Verizon is ignoring previous opt-out preferences in cases where people recently opted out. That email, which was forwarded to ours by a Verizon customer named Jordan Hirsch, says, quote, as a Verizon Selects participant, you will be automatically included in the Custom Experience Plus and Custom Experience programs. If you recently opted out of participating in Verizon Selects, you'll still be included in the Custom Experience program unless you opt out. So they're basically calling a reset and making everyone go opt out again if you don't want to be tracked. And I didn't get any notice about it. I didn't get an email about it. The only reason I know about it is because it's on several news sites. I happen to be reading the article from ours. So, yeah.
Good news. We realize you made the wrong choice. They're giving you a do-over.
It's like the Florida election all over again. Anyways, Hirsch also tweeted, since we were talking about old presidential elections, Hirsch also tweeted a screenshot of the email received from Verizon. The Verizon email Hirsch received did not state a specific time frame for recently opted out. Ours contacted Verizon today and asked for detail and asked why Verizon is enrolling people who previously opted out from the same program before the program's name was changed. We'll update the article if we get any answers. You're not getting any answers. We all know what they're doing.
They forgot.
We all know what they're doing.
The previous opt-out file got accidentally deleted. We shouldn't have let Steve in accounting move over to tech support. Verizon is very sad about this, I assure you.
All kinds of sad smiley faces in that tweet. Or emojis, whatever they're called these days. Verizon FAQ does not include the recently opted out language. Instead, makes it sound like all customers may be enrolled in Custom Experience, the non-plus version, regardless of previous opt-out status. Let's see. The author says he also was a customer and got a notification email from the company today. He's 99% sure that he opted out of Selects years ago. And the email said, you're in control. You'll be part of Customer Experience unless you opt out. I didn't even get the email. So, what information does newly renamed program collect? Both versions of Customer Experience use information about the website you visit and apps you use on your mobile device to help us determine your interests, such as sports lover or outdoor enthusiast or big black women. Wait, no, that one of those things wasn't on that list. Figure out which one. The Verizon FAQ says we only use the first part of the web address, the URLs you visit that include the top-level domain and the subdomain of the URL. We do not use information past the first backslash or question mark in the URL. For example, we would be able to infer you are interested in news if you visit a news-related website, but we wouldn't know what news articles you read. Bullshit! Excuse me. That just came right out. Custom Experience Plus users, all of the above, plus device location information we obtain from Verizon Network and from Verizon apps you have permitted to collect your location for these purposes, information about your Verizon Fios service, and customer proprietary network information, including information about the phone numbers you call, the times you receive these calls. That also includes information about the quantity, type, destination, location, and the amount of use on your Verizon telecommunications and interconnected voice over internet protocol services and related billing information. So every fucking thing.
Yeah, I could be wrong, but if you're on their network, don't they get to see the URLs you clicked on?
If you are not using a VPN or some other method of obfuscating your traffic, that would be correct. Because even if you're using SSL, you still see at least the domain.
They would know the link to the story, thus the story that I was reading.
Well, so there's a distinction there, Madman. You're talking about monitoring the network at the provider end. This is monitoring the device with an agent. This is Verizon pushing shit onto the phone to collect this information, rather than, it's probably their My Verizon app. But yeah, they're collecting the information straight from the phone rather than trying to gleam it from network monitoring. That is a distinction. It may be a distinction without a difference, but it is a distinction.
I was just thinking they're going to know. They're not going to not know what I'm looking at. Now, I don't want them to, have it directly on my phone, because then they're not just knowing what I'm looking at. They know what all's on my phone. And I don't have anything illegal on my phone. I just don't want them to know what's on there.
It's not their damn business. And that's the thing. I have nothing to hide argument. Fine. I don't want it running my battery down. I don't want their data collection running in the background using up my bandwidth. Yeah, I get that it's tiny. Yeah, I get that it's probably not that much. But if you've ever been in a scenario where you've got lousy signal in the first place, even just a little bit of extra data flowing through that line can fuck up and, prevent you from making calls or getting, a page loaded if you're trying to look something up.
Or you've used up our highest tier speed. You've now been moved to the lowest tier.
Well, that one they can do on the network side.
The whole reason I've moved up the used up the highest tier speed is you have shit running in the background using up my data, you fucking punk.
I mean, they're probably not counting their data collection against your well, I mean, fuck, I can't even say that. I would like to think they're not counting their data collection against your mobile usage or your data usage, but I don't know that. I mean, they might. I mean, it's a cell phone company we're talking about here. They are kind of greedy.
I mean, since they're not going to know how much data they're collecting from each individual user unless they put a flat, this is the most we think our app will ever collect, and just minus that from everyone's data usage, I don't see how they wouldn't.
Mm.
And I don't know that they care enough to do that.
Well, that's just it, too. They might just say, well, it's such a small amount of data. We're just, we're just going to leave it alone. So, and I'm sure somebody in their billing department is like, yes, yes, just let it go.
Well, even if it doesn't run up your bill, it slows down my internet eventually.
Yep.
Next story. I think we've all just decided that cell phone company should be set on fire.
I think
not
all of them.
Not that I encourage the setting of people on fire, but if this were to become socially acceptable, I may start a gasoline collection.
I peacefully set people on fire peacefully.
I'll just say I'd like to see more competition in these markets. I feel like that would solve a lot of these problems. It's like, oh, I have a choice of not using an asshole for an ISP? Well... Let's see. I mean, when your choice is a giant douche or a turd sandwich, I mean,
Every election since the beginning of time.
Next one up is from Data Center Dynamics, unless anybody had anything else on beating up the cell phone company.
Nah.
All right.
Dude.
The outage at Amazon Web Services U.S. East 1 cloud region impacted customers globally on December the 6th. Amazon subsidiaries like IMDb and Ring went down, as did games like PlayerUnknown's Battleground, Valorant, Clash of Clans. Does anybody care about Valorant or Clash of Clans?
Destiny, they're mobile games, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. I mean, somebody must. Destiny 2 and Dead by Daylight, amongst others. The issue began around 10:45 a.m. Eastern Time. Yep, I know. I logged into my when I saw it. I logged into my chat at work. I'm like, guys, this could be a problem. And so, yeah. As it happened, so they've got all these live updates. Update at 204. Amazon said we have executed a mitigation, which is showing significant recovery in US East 1. We are continuing to closely monitor the health of network devices, and we expect to continue to make progress toward full recovery. Do not have ETA. 2:43 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, Amazon. Why did they switch from Eastern Standard Time to Pacific Standard? That's interesting. At 2:43 p.m. Eastern PST, Amazon, we have mitigated the underlying issue that caused some network devices in U.S. East 1 region to be impaired. Oh, I wonder if they issued a circular loop. I wonder if they did a routing loop. You know, device at the end of the chain routes back to the beginning as opposed to dropping off where it should. You used to occasionally see shit like that with, like, if you let BGP and other things do automatic route configuration, you'd occasionally see that. So usually you wanted to set your default routes, but isn't Amazon PST? Yeah, that might be what's going on, is they might be mixing it up between the person writing the article and then these times coming from Amazon. That might be why they're jumping between PST and, you know, I didn't read out the IRC. In the IRC, we have Al Hazard, Cyber Large, Psychros, Madman, and myself. So, there we go. We're seeing improvement in availability across almost all AWS services. All services now independently working through service-by-service recovery. 303, many services are recovered. We're working towards full recovery for services like SSO, Connect, API Gateway. Well, API Gateway being down would be a large problem. Let's see. Yeah, so Amazon called it at 4:35 PST that they had everything completely repaired and they were just up to little break fix stuff. So the cause of the outage is not yet known. AWS does not currently list any issues on its status page. Amazon constantly doesn't admit when their shit's down. Most providers don't, but Amazon's bad about it. The cloud company has acknowledged the outage, saying we're experiencing API and console issues in U.S. East 1 region. We have identified the root cause, and we are actively working towards recovery. The issue is causing global console landing page, which is also hosted in U.S. East 1. So anybody who tried to log into their AWS account to move their shit into a different region that wasn't affected, well, the first place you land is the global console landing page, which you couldn't get to because it was down. And anybody who's worked with Amazon knows why that's fucking hilarious. The issue is affecting global, okay, which is hosted US one. Customers may be able to access region-specific consoles going to console instead of going to console AWS. Try us-west-2.console.aws.amazon.com. Blah 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 blah. So yeah, other things were affected. Other companies impacted include stock and crypto platform public.com, NFT site, Recur, adult webcam site CB Explorer, tech news website Protocol Audio Video Program Real Crafter version 2, software platform ConnectWise, Splunk's Rigor, M1 Finance, Duolingo, and more. Users of Disney Plus, League of Legends, Tinder, Instacart, Venmo, Robinhood, Roku, Kindle, and the McDonald's apps were also reporting problems. Warehouse workers at Amazon's e-commerce business were also impacted. So the reason I'm reading this, not because we don't all know this already, but good God, everything relies on AWS these days. I mean, one system going out, one service provider going out broke like half of the internet yesterday.
Paper Tiger.
Or I guess it was day before yesterday.
On an app.
It was the 7th. It was the 7th. So whenever that was, Tuesday. It was Tuesday. But yeah, I mean, like, you know, crypto platforms going down, you know, fucking League of Legends going down. And now the worst part is, if you ever work with Amazon, you know, they always claim they've got their five nines of uptime. But they don't count themselves as being down unless they don't have any regions up. So the way they'll say it is, well, if you want to get that five nines, you have to have your services using enough extra regions so that if one goes down, you're not impacted. Well, their own shit obviously wasn't doing that. But yeah, I mean, you can get it's in the contract language. You can actually get refunds from Amazon for service time being down. But they'll never, the way it's worded, it'll never actually happen because they have to have like most of their regions down for it to actually count against their five nines. So, And of course, all of their documentation is basically like, well, you should have used more than one region. And all of these people going down kind of gives you an indication of how much people really do that. I mean, it's not that Amazon makes it easy, by the way. Every time you switch between regions, it looks like a completely new account. So, go ahead, Madman.
And do they charge for subscriptions to multiple regions?
Oh, you know, Madman, with Amazon AWS, you don't pay subscriptions. You pay by usage. So, if you spin up a virtual machine, that has a base cost, and then CPU, memory, network bandwidth has a cost. Storage has a cost. It's all parted out, and a lot of the costs, the gigabyte in S3 is like a fraction of a penny, but it's constantly nickeling and diming you. So if you run a massive infrastructure in Amazon, you might as well be buying a data center. It's fucking expensive. It just doesn't look like it on paper because everything has its prices set really low until you look at the rates. You know, it's sort of like comparing the cost of gas by the liter versus cost of gas by the gallon, because it looks like it's cheaper when it's not, you know?
So. And that may be why there aren't people using multiple regions.
Yeah, because it's fucking expensive. The better option...
You want me to double my cost to get what you're trying to sell me with one region.
Yep. That's basically it. Now that said... You know, slipping into my day job here, the correct answer is not to rely on one cloud host. So don't put everything in Amazon and then use multiple regions. Have your shit in Amazon and Azure and, you know, DigitalOcean or Linode or, you know, that's kind of the point, of like using Docker or Kubernetes is being able to load your applications and your infrastructure up into pretty much any cloud provider. So if you've got your Terraform and your CloudFormation script set up correctly, a lot of times you can redeploy your infrastructure to a different cloud provider. So the trick there is designing your infrastructure to work across, you know, a couple of them so that if one goes down, you can just swap over to the other provider between your A and your B regions or your A and your B environments. Blue and green is what most people use. They'll be on blue and then deploy new code into green, test it, and then make green the active for customers. And you can get into all this network architecture shit. I mean, I could spend hours talking about this if you really want to, but I doubt it. So, what's he saying? If it's usage based, wouldn't multiple regions effectively divide the costs? Yeah, kind of. It depends. So... It depends on how you set up your regions and how you're balancing between them. There's base costs for a lot of the stuff, like spinning up VMs and things like that. Now, there's not. Last time I looked, there weren't so much base costs. Like if your applications are running primarily with serverless functions out of S3, and then like the built-in databasing stuff like that, a lot of those base costs are really just usage costs. And so if you're dividing it out among region. Yeah, and you might just be moving the load around, but VMs are what most people use because they're usually forklifting their apps from VMware and other shit. They're not. If you want to, you either have to build your app using the Amazon specific services that lock you into the Amazon system, or you run in generic virtual machines and containers, which all have base costs associated with them. So you have to spin up. You know, you're paying that base cost however many times for however many regions you're in. And that whole region thing adds a whole layer of complexity on top of it because you got to run load balancers and shit like that to, you know, properly do the regioning thing. So it gets complex and a lot of little ancillary stuff on top of it until you get, you know, a several thousand dollar AWS bill a month. So... I don't know. Al Hazard, you can go on the AWS console page and see the pricing for just base VMs. Like some of their high end ones are like a couple hundred bucks a month just for the VM, and that's not counting usage. Cost less in one region because they have less people managing it. That depends on how you set it up. costed them less with rendering. They're automated. Everything is fucking automated in AWS. That's one of the reasons why if you ever call their support, if you've done anything outside of the AWS documentation, be like, yeah, sorry, can't help you. It's all automated. There's no people involved there. Hell, they do the whole data racking thing where, like, okay, they don't fix their servers. They just turn off the broken ones and start spinning up new ones. And then if they have racks, you know, if a rack go out, they'll just shut the racks down. So, you know, they don't fucking care. Anyways, I mean, it's not the Amazon support is ass. It's not the worst I've used. That honor goes to Proofpoint. Anybody having to deal with Proofpoint email security, their support is the fucking worst. But yeah, Amazon's not great. Anyways, did you guys have anything else on that?
Yeah, no, we can move to summed the next it up.
One. I don't know if I can tell the Proofpoint stories or not.
Risk on the side of caution.
I don't think that made sense, Madman.
If it's risky, you go with the cautious side. So if you don't think you can, you don't.
Anyways, let's just say... Well, okay, so those Proofpoint appliances, they're Linux boxes. Their first-line support doesn't know how to work Linux. And yet, to make the way they sell these things, you don't get administrative access to the Linux box. You get administrative access to the application that's running. But if you need to do something at a lower level, and their frontline support doesn't understand what they're talking about, and oftentimes will refuse to escalate, you say, I'd like you to escalate up the chain. You obviously don't know what you're doing. Oh, no, I've got the book right here. We'll figure it out. Oh, for fuck's sake.
In trouble for escalating.
So, you know, when they refuse to escalate, the reason I'm not sure if I can talk about it or not, I got a contract canceled because of their support was so shit. And their head of support at the time called me to apologize for what they did. And I said, fuck it. I don't want to deal with you. You know, we've done this too many times. I don't want to fucking deal with you. I'm telling them not to renew your contract. Oh, what can we do to make it up to you? Like, the guy wanted to bribe me, basically. I told him to fuck off.
Yeah, I think we should move on.
No, I don't get mad at this shit.
Can't
not at all.
Next story.
The call girls that will require to give me a blowjob to get this over, so it's just, we'll agree that you're a retard and that I'm going to do business with someone else.
That's pretty much what it was. All right. Next one up is from NPR. Debt collectors can now text, email, and DM you on social media. Oh, let the scams begin.
Hello, I am with your medical provider. Your previous bill is past due, and we're going to send you to collections. Habib will break your knees unless you send us $45.
You can send me written proof of the debt via registered mail, and you are not to contact me again on this platform.
Don't worry, Facebook will contact you shortly. We will go through all of them.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. So, the next time someone tries to friend you on Facebook or follow you on Instagram, it could be a debt collector. New rules approved by the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau that took effect on Tuesday dictate how collections agencies can email and text people, as well as message them on social media to seek repayment for unpaid debts. Catherine L. Kranger, the former CFPB director who oversaw the rule change, said last year that they were a necessary update to the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, which is more than four decades old. Quote, we are finally leaving 1977 behind in developing a debt collection system that works for consumers and industry in the modern world, Kranger said in a blog post. Okay, debt collection never works for consumers. Can we all just agree on that? But consumer advocates say borrowers risk missing key information about their debts or falling prey to illegal scams if they're contacted online. Quote, the rules are really disappointing and concerning in a number of ways, unquote, said April Kuhnhoff, a staff attorney at the National Consumer Law Center. Under the new rules, debt collectors who contact you on social media have to identify themselves as debt collectors, but can attempt to join your network by sending you a friend request. Debt collectors must give you the option to opt out of being contacted online, and any messages they send have to be private. Collectors can't post on your page if it can be seen by your contacts or the public. Collection agencies can also email and text debitors, but must still offer the ability to opt out. Industry officials praised the move as a welcome change to the outdated methods currently used by the collections industry. Quote,
and that would be calls and actual snail mail, which is sufficient.
Quote, consumers in the collections process deserve to be on a level playing field with others in the financial services marketplace with recognition of their preference to use email and text messaging over other outdated methods, such as faxes, outlined in the current law. Unquote, Mark Neeb, CEO of ACA International, a trade association for debt collectors, said in the statement. Mark
so
Neeb.
That's the collector side of it. I didn't hear anyone from the... consumer side of it
saying, good God, people. I mean, you know,
usury should be a death penalty offense.
I mean, this is
how we solve this problem, make usury a death sentence.
So, you want to pay cash for houses and cars for their going forward.
Yep.
Actually, that would probably bring a lot of the pricing down, as most people
couldn't
afford to.
Would solve a lot of problems, man, if we get away from centralized banking and go back to... Anyway, I'm going to find myself on the fucking suicide list if I keep talking like that.
I just want to point out, you can get away with centralized banking without getting away from banking.
Not in time or the place of the discussion, madman.
Neither the time nor the crayons to explain...
They'll end up saying something very wrong. Well, it's very right, but average people would think it's very wrong.
Kuhnhoff said, you're fine. Kuhnhoff says consumers should have been given the ability to opt into electronic messages rather than being forced to opt out of them. She suggests that consumers who don't check social media regularly or miss an email may fail to see critical information about a debt. Many people don't have regular access to the internet either, she added. Allowing debt collectors to email, text, and use social media to contact consumers also gives criminals a new avenue to swindle people out of their money, a practice Kuhnhoff expects to increase in the future, and this is the real reason I'm pissed about this. Quote, I have actually already gotten my first spam debt collection email even before the new rules took effect, unquote, she said. Quote, so certainly we should anticipate more bad actors who are trying to scam people into paying them money on alleged debts, unquote. Kuhnhoff suggests that consumers shouldn't click on links from people they don't know and that they could report any problems with debt collection messages to the CFPB. The new rules were devised during the Trump administration when the Bureau became more business-friendly than it had in the past. Kranger resigned in January at the request of President Biden, who nominated Rohit Chopra to be the new agency's director, or to be the agency's new director. We'll read that correctly. The new rules also set a limit for the first time on how often debt collectors can call you. Agencies will be restricted to 7 calls per week per account in collection. So they're only supposed to call you once a day. But on Facebook and Twitter, they're just going to spam the fuck out of you. In your email box.
Given a new reason to hate the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau.
I mean, this is going to be so ripe with people saying, hi, I'm a debt collector. You owe us, you know, $100 on this. Please cohere and pay it to make us go away. And most people either won't know what it is, might think it's real, or they might try to argue with the person. They'll send them the link to the thing. No, we're a debt collector. See, we're allowed to do this now. And yeah. Al has on in IRC, I'm ready for debt collectors to hit me up on Second Life.
Xbox. I'm playing
Second
Call
Life,
of Duty.
Here is your field of penises, sir. Start sucking them.
I think you're right. I think you're right there. Are you? It will be on things like Xbox Live, and you'll be in the middle of a Halo match, and it'll just pop up. It's like, hey, I'm Fred from Collections. You owe us $500.
when this pay it forward bullshit started, like, became really easy. You can just buy it now and pay later. Dude, it's just going to enslave this next generation into a nickel and dime fucking debt all across multiple. Instead of being in debt to one company, you're going to be in debt to hundreds of them. That's what this is, man.
Last week, we talked about the thing being Microsoft was putting into Edge for payday loans.
That's what I'm saying, man. These little loan things that are being approved everywhere, I'm going to put it down to malice. They're doing this on purpose to fuck over the next generation, because they're not taking home loans because they can't afford them, because they're getting into massive amounts of debt with these little mini transactions, which are gamified like a motherfucker on the phone. I don't know, man. Just burn it down and start again.
So I will say, in all seriousness, if you start getting contacted through email or if a debt collector contacts you, no matter how they do it, you always have the same response. You ask them to mail you proof of the debt via registered mail, and that you will deal with it when you receive it, and to please not contact you until you're ready to deal with the debt that they've proven that you own. That's all you can do. Because now, if they're an actual legit debt collection agency and it's a real debt and you owe it, they will mail you proof of the debt and you should fucking pay it because you owe it. Even if it is a little payday lender thing, right? If you were dumb enough to take it out, you should pay for it. Right?
And they'll be sending it regular mail. They're not going to send it registered.
Well, I know, but you request it. You want to make it sound official. You're right. They will just mail it. But yeah, you request proof of the debt via mail so that you have it on paper. And if you really own it, yeah, you should pay it. If they're fake, they'll either try to argue with you that they shouldn't have to do that, or they'll try to get you to click a link, or they'll try to email you something. You say, nope, I want it on paper. There's a reason you want it on paper. Because if you're going to dispute it in court and it's on paper, it's a hell of a lot easier.
That, and a legitimate company is going to spend 50 cents to send you the bill.
Yeah. If they're a scammer, they'll argue with you. They won't. They'll try to send you something electronic. It won't make sense. It'll be confusing. It won't. And they'll continue to try to harass you if they think they're going to get a payout from you. So if they are a scammer, though, you should totally screw with them. You know, if you figure out somebody's a debt collection scammer, say, you know, start asking for the debt, proof of the debt. And if they argue with you and they say, oh, we can't send that to you for stupid reasons, say, all right, well, I've just declared bankruptcy. Good fucking luck. You know, shit like that. So anyways. Yes, and you have to pay. There it is. You have to pay us the outstanding debt in Google Play cards, or what was the green pack? Was that the other one?
That's another one.
Yeah. All right. Next one up is from Mac Rumors. Unless you guys had anything else on that.
Good.
Okay. Loose interpretations of Apple's privacy policies have allowed Facebook and Snapchat to continue tracking users for targeted advertising even when they've asked not to be tracked, the Financial Times reports. In May, Apple launched its app tracking transparency feature that allows users to opt out of being tracked across apps and websites for advertising purposes. 7 months after Apple introduced the feature, companies such as Snapchat and Facebook have purportedly been allowed to continue sharing user-level signals from phones, iPhones, provided that the data is anonymized and aggregated rather than directly linked to specific user profiles. The Financial Times said that Apple's position was the result of, quote, an unacknowledged shift that lets companies follow much looser interpretations of its controversial privacy policy, unquote. Apple has instructed developers that they may, quote, may not derived data from a device for the purposes of uniquely identifying it, unquote, which developers have interpreted to mean that they can still observe signals and behaviors from groups of users instead, enabling these groups to be shown tailored ads anyways. Apple has not explicitly endorsed the technique, but they have allowed third parties to track and analyze groups of users regardless of whether or not they've given consent to user-level tracking. In addition, Apple reportedly continues to trust apps to collect user-level data such as IP address, location, language, device, and screen size, even though some of this information is passed on to advertisers. Snapchat investors were told the company plans to share data from its 306 million users, including those who asked the app not to track with advertisers so they can gain a more complete real-time view, unquote, of the success of ad campaigns. Likewise, Facebook is undertaking a multi-year effort to rebuild ad infrastructure, quote, using more aggregated or anonymized data, unquote, according to the company's operations chief. In June, Apple faced pressure to tighten the rules around app tracking transparency after it was found that third parties were using workarounds to identify users who do not consent to be tracked, but there have been no changes to the looser probabilistic methods of user identification. Or probabilistic, anyways. So, the whole anti-tracking thing's all cat and mouse. They'll figure out one thing, move on to the next, figure out something else, move on to the next. All I can say is opt out as much tracking as you can, make it obvious, and, you know, maybe don't install Facebook and Snapchat on your phone. There's an article.
How would I live without Facebook on my phone?
I think you'll be okay. You managed before before the year 2000. That said, there are third-party apps for social media sites that are supposed to sandbox it. So you can research that. I was looking at one called Friendly. Supposedly it helps track some of that, you know, keep all that stuff contained. Looked like what it really was like an encapsulated browser. And when I was playing with it. But there's supposedly several that do that. So look at reviews, you know, try to find one that actually works and isn't just a scam. That's kind of a problem these days with most of these mobile networks. But I'd say be you should be judicious about what apps you put on your phone. You need to recognize any of them could go mad with data collection, right? So if you don't, you know, if your life is not on Facebook, don't put Facebook on your phone. If your life is not in Twitter, don't put Twitter on your phone. I know there are people who make a living off their social media profiles and that they have to have this shit on their phone. Well, okay, just understand what you're doing. I'm not saying you can't do it. I'm just saying you should understand the choice you're making. And if it doesn't bother you that they're doing that collection so they can show you ads, well, I mean, some people it doesn't bother. I think it's wasteful and I don't like it. But I don't think it's as harmful as it's made out to be. I just think it's not good. So I try to avoid it when I can. But anyways, either of you have anything on that before we move on to the next one?
I'm good.
I'm not going to go with the app itself is harmful. I'm going to go with the product is harmful. Facebook shouldn't be your lens through the world. You'll actually see the world. And social networks aren't social. Talking to a person is social. Hanging out, playing cards, and drinking is social. Facebook is not social.
Yeah, we need to plan one of those. We haven't gotten to do that in a bit. Anyways. Next article is from GHacks. I'm not going to read the whole thing because we're close to time and we are trying to keep that hour. Short version, people running pirated versions of Office are getting messages in it that basically they're getting an option box that you can go in to, you know, if you click it, it'll take you to a special page where they're apparently offering half off for an Office 365 subscription to get people to quit pirating old versions of Office, trying to get them on Office 365.
Here's how you can get me on Office. Sell me the product. I don't need a subscription. I just want a copy.
I, I kind of like this.
Using OpenOffice.
Yeah, that's what I do. But well, LibreOffice, one of the two. Anyways, I kind of get a kick out of this idea that it's like, oh, you've got a pirated version of Office. Instead of trying to sue them, and so it's like you just offer them a discount, half off on a subscription to 365. That's not the worst option because a lot of people will pirate stuff early when they don't have a lot of money because, you know, they see it as a waste, and then later in life they might, you know, be able to afford stuff. I'm like, hey, you know what? So, I mean, that's not the worst way to go. So, but yeah, I kind of agree. I think you're better off this day and age installing like LibreOffice and using that if you need an office suite, or if you, you know, if your job needs Office 365, they're probably paying for it and you can use your work subscription. Don't mix up your personal stuff and your work stuff and your Office 365. I'm just saying for your personal stuff, Office is usually overkill anyways. So,
I might be weird. I just like the idea of owning software.
No, that's not weird.
Instead of everything is a subscription model.
That's one of the reasons I'm using a Libre for CAD for 3D printing these days, because all the other major CAD software is now subscription-based and cloud-based, which is obnoxious because I was starting to play around with SolidWorks through the aircraft group, and then they've switched it up, and it's now all you have to log into a website to launch the software that's installed on your computer. It's like, what the fuck? So, yeah.
That's fucked up.
Libre. That's the only one you still get to own your CAD software. So it's like, okay, that's what we're using now. That or FreeCAD, but I tried to use FreeCAD, I think, version 0.17. I had problems with it. So, and the last story I have for tonight is from The Guardian. I'm just going to summarize it, even though it's not that long of a story. German court has ruled that a man who slipped while walking the few meters from his bed to his own office can claim workplace accident insurance because he was technically commuting. So the article goes on where they're trying to figure out how many trips count as a journey to work when you're working from home. So from his bedroom to his office, like the first one in the morning counts and then the last one in the evening counts, but none of the others. But because he slipped and fell on his first trip and apparently broke his back on a spiral staircase, so that sucks. But yeah, so he gets to claim insurance to his work because it was commuting to work.
Well, I think OSHA should pay a visit to his house and see if it's up to code, because it doesn't sound like it is. He's violated workplace health and safety regulations.
Yeah, that's downside.
That's a two-edged sword, man.
It gets stupid quick, right? I mean, this is a good excuse for companies not to offer work from home, is because they don't want to have to deal with this shit. So,
on that one, it wouldn't be up to him to make sure his house was on code, so that's just going after the employer again.
Which means the employer is even less likely to offer remote work in the future.
OSHA compliance and workman's comp. Oh, why would it be the first one? I get breaks at work.
I don't know.
My
the article
15-minute breaks should be covered with me walking around.
The article didn't really cover it. They just said that that was the determination of the court. So I guess this was a whole argument that went back and forth in there about how many trips between the bedroom and the home office count as commuting to work.
I wouldn't even just go commuting to work. I was on break on work premises. I'm working from home. I didn't leave my house. I was still on the premises. I got hurt.
I slipped and hit that early, but that's okay. Do you have anything else on that?
No, I'm good.
All right. I've only got one thing for you tonight in Dojo, and that's a documentary that's on YouTube. It's actually been up there since 2014. It's a bunch of interviews from Dartmouth about the birth of the basic programming language and operating system. So it's pretty cool because they're interviewing people about some of the professors and students involved in putting BASIC together and the old mainframe computers they were using. These were cabinet computers, right? And it's actually kind of pre-mainframe, truthfully, because the stuff's in the 60s. And, you know, it's all terminals and punch cards. And, like, when I think of BASIC, I'm thinking of like the Commodore 64 or QBasic, you know, stuff from the 80s, early 90s, or my, you know, or my graphing calculator. I don't know how many of you guys wrote basic programs on your calculator to get through all of your tests. I certainly did. But I had a couple of professors who knew I was writing programs on the calculator. And they said, well, if you understand the problem well enough to write the program, then, you know, obviously it's okay for you to use it. Just don't give it to anybody. I'm like, okay, that's fine with me. So, but yeah, so I think of basic programming as, you know, basically something from the 90s, early 80s and into the 90s. But it's actually from the 60s. So it's kind of a fascinating documentary because it talks about how they brought in this young professor from Hungary because the guy was originally from Hungary, but because the math department had all these people who were retiring, and they had to get in a bunch of new professors, and apparently they expensed the first computer they bought as furniture because it was, you know, the size of a cabinet. So,
oh, back when debugging meant going in and sweeping the bugs out of the gears.
Yep. And they were talking about how they were writing the early, you know, programs. Like, you know, the professor was watching the computer to see if it worked, and the student was watching the computer to see if it worked for different reasons. The professor was watching to make sure the basic compiler worked. The student was watching to make sure their basic program worked. It's fascinating. It's good stuff. So it's about half hour long, or 40 minutes, 38 minutes. Yeah, there you go. So it's a fascinating, I got a kick out of it anyways. So, but yeah, if you can't get to the show note links, it's a Birth of Basic on YouTube. The original one was posted in 2014. So, and it's from Dartmouth. So, anyways, it's a good video. That's all I have for tonight. Of course, listen to the stream. I'm always working on it. Peer decking every Thursday. The Galaxy 15 radios site and the subreddit. In the IRC, I think I already read it out. Al Hazard, Cyberlard, Psychros, Madman, and myself. Madman, closing thoughts.
WebEx should be eliminated. That's it.
RU, closing thoughts.
I just had two of my good boats got sunk by whoever, but now I need another pirate ship to ride on. Sucks for me this weekend.
Yeah, I got you. Anyway. All right, sound effects time.
He's going to rape you. Repeatedly.
That's it, man. Game over, man. Game over.
Down for a nose down and call it a night.
Shut up, Wesley.